Today, remembering David Carr. David Carr died this week. Carr was the media columnist for the New York Times. He collapsed in the newsroom and died very suddenly. Carr was, well, simply brilliant. A storyteller, acerbic, truth-teller, remarkable guy with a remarkable story. We will all miss him. So here again is my interview with David Carr after the publishing of his book, The Night of the Gun. David Carr, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure to be with you.
You know, the image I kept thinking of with this book, as you delved back into parts of your life that you had not only forgotten, but wanted to forget, you know, drug abuse and beating up women, abandoning children so you could go get drugs. I mean, this is a very dark picture of anyone, let alone one that one paints for oneself. Anyway, the image that I came up with was of a proctologist attempting to do their own exam. You know, this book, that's what it felt like to me.
It didn't feel like that doing it. It was more, I mean, I've never been a proctologist, so unless there's a sharp turn in my career path, it's probably not going to happen. It felt more like archaeology in that you would get into a spot, you would sort of know where you were, and you kind of had to take out the axe and chop around and pull stuff out and find markers and evidence of what really happened. And I kind of stayed apart from it in terms of doing the interviews and doing the writing. I pretended like I was reporting about and writing about someone else, so I wanted to be fair and complete and put all the behavior in context, but I didn't want to cut any corners. Now that the book is out, it feels a little bit more like proctology.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Self-administered or not.
You know, you were so brutally, brutally honest about yourself, and you went to the extraordinary step of putting everything online so that people could see what the interviews that you did. I mean, it was really extraordinary. But first, paint a big picture of who you are, who you were, and this book.
Well, right now I'm speaking to you from a back porch in New Jersey, and there's a car out here that works and a family inside that likes me and a job in the city that I'm good at. I've got a few problems with my lawn, but otherwise I'd say I'm a good member of this little town I live in. 20 years ago, I was involved in buying and selling felony weight, coke, doing my share of it, snorting it, smoking it, shooting it, getting in scrapes with a lot of guys and two women, physical violence, at least 11 arrests, probably a bunch more. I think the clinical terms is low-bottom, poly-addicted loser.
And so what prompted you to set out to bring this evil twin past self to light?
Well, the twins that are in the book and are kind of the heart of the story had grown up and became of college age. And when you're a journalist working on a sort of fixed salary, a tuition will tend to beckon the muse a little bit and focus the mind. And when I checked the cupboard for what I might do, I report on media quite a bit. And I could have done a media book and probably sold to eight of my friends if I would have really leaned on them a bunch. And in terms of what I had in available assets, I had this very textured past. And I thought there would be artistic and cultural value in taking a different approach, taking what I do in my day job, which is finding people, talking to them, and finding sort of the truth that's between people. To report out this story would lead to a good narrative, and I thought I'd be good at writing this kind of book because I used to write a lot of cops and robbers stuff, and this is material I knew intimately, even though there were a lot of blank spots in the tape.
And did people try to persuade you that this was insane?
Well, I finished the book. I wrote it last summer in the Adirondacks, and one of the first people I sent it to was my oldest brother, John, who's really a smart guy who knows me pretty well and understands culture pretty well. And his thoughtful response was, "Whoa, dude, don't do this. Don't do it. You're crazy. Don't put this stuff out there." And he suggested specific cuts around the things you mentioned, violence against women, abandoning children. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, it was kind of like that sort of Tower of Sticks. If you reach in and try and pull one of the sticks out, the whole apparatus falls down. I didn't think if I cut a corner that I couldn't really talk about it in the way that I wanted to. I couldn't, you know, if the book came out and purported to be a true story about how that guy became this guy. And then I was interviewing behind it, and we got two of those yeah, but moments. I don't think it would have worked. I think it pretty much all had to be out there, as truthfully told as possible.
Yeah, let alone that if you had left out the really, really bad bits, somebody would have brought them forward.
I think in this day and age, to suggest that which can be known won't be known is a silly and fallacious way to look at the world. This informational ecosystem that we live in has a way of bubbling up almost everything, and it's a transparent culture whether you choose to treat it that way or not. So I just decided from jump, anything I could find or the investigators I hired or the reporter I hired could find, I just put in the book.
Let's go back to how bad it was. I mean, the title of the book is The Night of the Gun, and you get into great detail about how you didn't remember you ever having a gun and how a lot of people corrected you. Let's start there, but if you could, paint a picture of the kind of person you were at the height of your illness.
A lot of drunk memoir begin with the horrid childhood where the neighbor preyed on them, or the life of deprivation or horrid circumstance. I had none of that. I was born into a really loving home in a nice suburb of Minneapolis, and I had to walk a long ways to get in trouble, and I did. I sort of pretended to be a gangster until I became one. I was a journalist. I became a journalist and a good one, but other people might try coke and then go on to other things and say, wow, that was interesting. For me, once I did it, that was the only thing, and so I progressed through a cycle of first buying and then selling powdered cocaine and then smoking coke in crack form and eventually ending with intravenous coke use. And that was pretty much all I did for several years straight. It's an incredibly boring and frightening activity at the same time.
And along the way, you had your brushes with the law, as you mentioned, and these abusive relationships with a couple of women, and then you became a father.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason that I was able to come out the other end, I think, had to do with race and gender. I picked up one felony and at least 10 or 12 misdemeanors, and I think if I hadn't had the wherewithal to obtain and be represented by able counsel, we might be doing this interview from federal prison. So I think I was advantaged by circumstance. And the other thing is I did sober up. I did get custody of my twin children. Their mother was also very involved in the drug lifestyle. And at that point, we were both on welfare. We were all on welfare, and I really didn't have a job. And I think, you know how in the culture, if you're a woman, a single mother alone with twin girls and no visible means of support, people have a lot of names for that kind of person. Whereas I was a male and with twin baby girls, and people were completely charmed by that and helped me at every turn. So this story is a lot about all the breaks I got along the way. And I ended up working with the people I had worked with as a journalist back when I was a full meth addict. And little by little, slowly by slowly, I got better jobs until I woke up one day and, you know, my luggage came down the carousel and the name tag said New York Times on it. And I said, some terrible mistake must have been made.
How did you recover?
Well, it's not nice to say. It's not appropriate to say you're always supposed to recover for self and do for self. But when my twins were born and I ended up, you know, immersed in the drug lifestyle with newborn children, I had been a bad husband. I had been married earlier in life. I never married the mother of the kids. I had been a bad employee, a bad brother and sister, a bad friend. I really hated being a bad dad. I couldn't stand it. There was nothing in my upbringing. And I think that the sort of presence of these two twins made me look hard in the mirror and say, you know, I'll do almost anything to get high except maybe destroy these children. I'm not ready for that. I don't think God would forgive that. That's the feeling that I had. And so I went into Eden House, which is a long-term treatment center, was in there for 6 months, and sort of gradually remembered who I was supposed to be and, you know, did everything else people do in those circumstances. Said the cliches, did the praying, went to the meetings. I did what others told me to do, and little by little I put together 14 years of sobriety.